Toy with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Sabine.
And I'm Amanda. Welcome to the 55th episode of Robots. In today's episode, we talk with Brian Yamauchi from iRobot. It turns out that both Sabine and I were attending the same workshop as him at ICRA. A couple of words to Brian. After a PhD in computer science and years of research at the Naval Research Laboratory, he went on to work at iRobot, where he is now lead roboticist.
After the interview, we'll be inviting you to debate on whether the military's involvement in robotics is good for the field, so stay with us until the end of the show. But first, as always, let's listen to the latest news in robotics from Christine.
Thanks, Sabine. Startup company Hydronalix from Arizona has developed an autonomous robot lifeguard. The robot consists of a flotation device attached to an electric impeller which drives it at speeds of up to 45 kilometers an hour. A remote-controlled version of the robot lifeguard is currently used to patrol Malibu's dangerous Zuma Beach, where 25 additional robot lifeguards will follow by December. The autonomous version of the robot uses sonar to home in on the underwater movements associated with a swimmer in distress. It will go on sale next spring for 2,800 euros or $3,500 US. In a video reminiscent of Frank Herbert's Dune novels, researchers at Georgia Tech in Atlanta have shown a robot that can swim through sand. Like the salamander robot you may remember from a previous interview with Aoki Eispert, this robot's morphology and locomotion pattern are modeled after that of a real lizard. However, while previous research for movement in water or air could rely on detailed dynamic models, no such models exist for sand, which can behave as both a solid and a fluid. The current prototype of the robot uses an oscillation pattern gleaned from the real lizard to efficiently move through a container filled with plastic spheres 6 millimeters across. The researchers are now refining their robot by adding more jointed segments to allow for a smoother body movement. Eventually, lizard-like robots could help find people trapped in the loose debris resulting from an earthquake. For videos of this week's robots news, including the autonomous robot lifeguard and the sand-swimming salamander robot, have a look at the forum at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Thanks, Christine. We now speak with Brian Yamauchi, who is lead roboticist at iRobot, where he's been working for more than 10 years. In his role, he gets to direct some really high-tech projects with names such as Wayfarer, Daredevil, R-Gator, or Valkyrie. And in particular, during this interview, he'll be telling us about the business of robotics and the PackBot, which is the basis for many of their projects. He also tells us how to design good human-robot interactions to make sure that these soldiers can actually use the robots in the end, or some of the more long-term or futuristic projects which they've been working on, including the Cambot and Jambot projects, which involve making soft and deformable robots. Okay, so let's dive right in. Hi, Brian. Welcome to Robots.
Hello, Sabine.
Can you please present yourself to our listeners?
Oh, my name is Brian Yamauchi. I'm a lead roboticist with the iRobot Research Group. I tend to do a lot of research in robot autonomy, behavior-based systems, navigation, mapping, as well as high-speed mobility for robots and control.
And what is the raison d'être of iRobot?
Well, so the goal is basically to make robots to make a difference in the world. You know, when I joined the company, the motto of the company was basically have fun, make money, build cool stuff, and change the world. And they've also added deliver great products. So basically, the goal is to deliver robots that actually make a difference in people's lives, whether it's in the government side, helping to deliver robots which help to protect soldiers, or whether it's on the consumer side, delivering robots that help to make people's lives easier.
I think a lot of roboticists want to make fun robots which make a difference, but somehow they're not leaving the lab. So what's the secret ingredient iRobot find to actually make real-world products?
I think it was an interesting challenge because we started off as primarily a research-oriented company, and then we had this transition process where we transitioned into actually learning how to build these products, both for the government and for the consumer side. When I joined the company, it was about 11 years ago, so it was much smaller at that time, and I was just starting up the learning curve. So I think there are a couple of key elements. First, obviously, the robot has to be useful. It has to meet a need out there. And then there's the whole process of, on the consumer side, getting the cost down. Or, you know, consumer engineers will argue over cost, over a component that costs, you know, 5 cents, because it makes a difference when you're making millions of these robots and figuring out how to make these robots cheaply and distribute them all around the world. Whereas on the government side, there's a different challenge. You have a much higher price point, but you have much harder robustness standards where, for example, a PackBot needs to survive a fall onto concrete from 3-meter height. So you've got to really do a lot of engineering to get it to be robust to work in the real world and not fail after, you know, 2 days of running around in the desert.
So one thing you said at ICRA was, when is it interesting to call a robot a robot? So from a business perspective, when is that interesting?
I think it's interesting in the sense that people are, from a business perspective, I think people are becoming more accepting of robots. One of the interesting things back in the early days of the Roomba product was, initially when it was sold as a robotic vacuum cleaner, because there's a perception that people might be hesitant or scared of robots. But now being a robot is a selling point. It's not sold as a cleaning robot. So you can draw the line in different places, but I think from a business perspective, people are much more open to robotics, and they're very interested, you know, again, both in the consumer side and the government side, in how robots can help to make their lives easier.
In this interview, I really wanted to dive into the R&D being done at iRobot. First, what resources do you have for research and development over there?
So we've got a research group here that's been growing pretty rapidly. We're up to around 25 or 30 people. We have researchers who've come from a variety of different labs, from MIT, from JPL, from CMU, and so forth. And we have an ongoing research project, ongoing projects that range from relatively near-term applied research to extend the capability of our robots to much farther out, longer-term research, which won't lead directly into a product, but might help enable the products from 10 years from now.
Do you do everything in-house, or do you also collaborate with universities?
We do a lot of collaboration. So we collaborate with MIT, CMU, Georgia Tech, Brown University, the list goes on and on. We're very interested in collaborating with the best of university, as well as the best of industry and government, and bringing in innovative researchers from all these areas to work on these really challenging problems.
Can you give us a high-level overview of what type of research areas iRobot is interested in?
So we're interested in a variety of different areas. Our main focuses include autonomy and semi-autonomy, basically giving the robots more intelligence so they can figure out how to work on their own. Then we're also interested in multi-robot coordination, so basically figuring out how robots can work together in groups. We're interested in human-robot interface, so the whole area of how can we make it easier for humans to direct and operate the robots and interact with them in a more natural way. And finally, we're also interested in advanced platforms, robots that work mechanically or behaviorally in completely new ways.
iRobot basically has two fairly different parts, one which is more on the military side and one which is more on the domestic side. How can research across these areas, how can each area contribute to the other, basically?
I think there's, you know, it's very true. They are very different applications, and they're also, the other challenge is they're very different price points. But I think One of the things that we could do is we can, in research, you know, on the government side, investigate technologies which right now may be very expensive to implement, but which in the future could come down in price as technology comes down in price in general and eventually become feasible on consumer robots. And likewise, I think on the consumer side, they've done a lot of work in making robots robust and autonomous for doing simple tasks in a wide variety of environments. And they basically have the experience with millions of these robots out there in the world. And that sort of information about how do you make robots robust and autonomous in a wide variety of environments can definitely be useful for the government side as well.
Okay, let's start with the semi-autonomy. A lot of your semi-autonomous robots are based on the PackBot platform. So can we start by looking at that platform? Can you describe it to us?
Sure. It's the PackBot is a platform, weighs about 50 pounds. It's man-portable, so it's designed so that a soldier can carry it on his or her back, and it includes tracks, so it sort of looks like a miniature tank. But it also includes these flippers, and the flippers have the advantage that you can climb over rocks that are taller than the robot, and you can also use it to climb up and down stairs. On some of these PackBots, in fact, most of them, we have this manipulator arm, this 6-degree of freedom arm called the EOD, or Explosives Ordnance Disposal Manipulator, and the bulk of the robots have been developed for EOD purposes in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, where they're deployed to help soldiers investigate suspected IEDs, improvised explosive devices, such as roadside bombs, and determine, is that really a threat? And if it is a threat, deal with it using either explosives or a disruptor or something like that, something that'll destroy the explosive harmlessly while everyone is out of harm's way.
What do we mean by semi-autonomy?
So there's a spectrum of autonomy which we're interested in, and it ranges from, at one end of the spectrum, what we call teleoperation, which basically means that the operator is driving the robot like you might play a video game. You're seeing through the robot's eyes, through the cameras, and you're joysticking every move. And at the other extreme, we have full autonomy, which basically means you give a robot a high-level instruction like map out this building, and then the robot goes and does it entirely on its own. What semi-autonomy does is it addresses points intermediate on that continuum. So it could be everything from driver assist behavior. So maybe what that would mean is rather than joysticking it constantly, you might just click at a location on the screen and say, go there, or you might say, follow this hallway, and so forth. Or to higher level semi-autonomy, which goes further along the spectrum towards autonomy, where you might give it an instruction like, follow the perimeter of this building, or go into this room and check to see whether anyone is in there. And so we're basically interested in all the points along that spectrum, but in particular in pushing things more towards the autonomous side.
So for the PackBot, what would be a good level of autonomy?
So it depends on the task. We've done some research in some higher levels of autonomy in terms of building up maps autonomously of the environment, telling it to do basically urban reconnaissance, allowing it to map the insides of buildings as well as the outsides and follow streets. That's slightly longer term. In the very near term, we're thinking about simple driver assist semi-autonomous behaviors like self-righting. So if the robot tips over, it can lift itself back up and put itself back on its treads using its arms. And retro-traverse, which means once the driver has driven the robot to a destination and has finished its mission, he can just press a button which tells it come back home and it'll come back home automatically.
You mentioned mapping before, and I know you're equipping this PackBot with lots of cool sensors. Can you maybe say a word about that?
Sure. We're very interested in mapping and in perception in general, and we've been looking at both indoor and outdoor sensors. We've integrated a number of sensor modalities. We typically use LiDAR sensors, which basically use the laser to give you a map of a two-dimensional outline of where obstacles are, and LiDAR is attractive because it's long range and it's very accurate, but it only allows you to, typically, most LiDARs are planar, which means it only tells you within a two-dimensional plane where objects are. So if something is above or below that plane, it may not pick it out. There are various ways to deal with that, and we've been looking at things like flash LiDARs, which are basically send out a big pulse of a laser energy and then reads it back, and then that allows you to see the 3D structure of the world. We've also been looking at stereo vision, and we've been looking at radar sensors as well. And the advantages of different things are stereo vision is lower cost, and it gives you this 3D perspective. Whereas ultra-wideband radar, which is one of the things we've been looking at, it allows you to see through fog and dust and rain and snow. And so while, for example, the radar is not as accurate as the LiDAR, it will allow you to operate in some environments which you couldn't normally operate with the LiDAR only if, for example, the robot was completely surrounded by fog or by dust.
So thanks to this ultra-wideband, basically you're aiming towards getting near real-world scenarios, basically. How far are we from really being able to deploy these, mapping the world, et cetera?
I think we're pretty close. We've certainly, you know, we've got thousands of robots, over 3,000 packbots in the field. They're mostly currently teleoperated, but we've got the hardware that will allow you to build the world. And again, there's sort of this continuum. So at the simple end of the continuum, you might just have the operator driving the robot around and the robot building up a map as the operator drives around. And those sorts of things are probably likely to be possible in the very near future. And the level above that is giving the robot a higher level directive to, say, explore a building. And I've demonstrated some of those techniques. Actually, before I was at iRobot, I worked at the Naval Research Lab in Washington, D.C. And one of the things I was working on there was a concept called frontier-based exploration, which is basically a way to get the robots to autonomously explore an unknown environment by navigating to the boundaries between space that is known to be clear and space that's unknown. So basically, we've got that in the laboratory, and it'll still take some work to get that out into the real world, but I think that's certainly possible within a few years.
What are still the main challenges in achieving this final goal you just mentioned?
I think the main challenges are basically integrating a good sensor, good source of perception, which will allow you to gain to see the full 3D structure of the world, and then just doing the research on the behaviors and the autonomy to get it to be really robust. So you want to make sure it's not going to get stuck or it's going to be able to unstick itself if it gets stuck, and so that it'll be able to deal with a wide variety of different environments.
You actually made the PackBot fly, right?
Yeah, we actually had a research project. This is called the Griffin Project, which was funded by the Army, which was basically just a proof of concept. Well, we had a simple PackBot attached to this gas motor, and we were able to use the gasoline motor to propel this propeller, and then we also had this parafoil, like a square parachute, as an airfoil. And we were able to use that to remote control a PackBot so it could take off and fly up a couple hundred feet and drive around and then also come back down for a landing.
Rather than having a PackBot that flies, you've also been looking into having teams of ground vehicles and aerial vehicles. Why is it interesting to have robots collaborate?
It's interesting for a number of reasons. One of the main reasons is it allows you to get different sorts of perspectives. So you could have multiple ground robots, which give you multiple perspectives on the ground, on the environment. But in addition to that, you can combine things like air vehicles, which have the top-down God's eye view of the world, which can see over obstacles and maybe see different areas that the robots on the ground can't see. And the advantage of air vehicles is they give you this high-level perspective and you can see over obstacles and so forth. The disadvantages are that you can't really get as close and also that you can't necessarily loiter over the target as long. So in that case, you might have the air vehicles directing the ground vehicles to go to a particular location and then check it out and then get a close-up view.
In collaborative systems, you often want your guys to communicate. How challenging is that?
It can be challenging. It depends on the environment, and we've certainly got basic wireless communications for all the robots, but it's always an issue of a trade-off in terms of how much bandwidth is available, how much radio bandwidth, and how much information you want to send, and how much autonomy you put in the robots. So one of the advantages of increased autonomy is you can reduce the amount of information you send back. So if you're joysticking a robot down an urban street, for example, and you're doing pure teleop, you need constant real-time high-resolution video being sent so you can steer around all the obstacles. But if you're giving it a higher-level directive, like go down the street, and the robot has the autonomy to deal with that, then you maybe only need snapshots every second or two, and you don't need that same high-bandwidth video.
I know you guys are working on these Landroids, right?
Right.
So with respect to the Landroids, what are you trying to investigate with regards to communication?
So the Landroid project is looking at a network of small robots. These are handheld robots, which can communicate with each other and self-form a network. So basically, the idea is that each one of these nodes acts like a communication repeater, relay. So in effect, you build your own internet, and you build it dynamically so it can deal with different sorts of environments where there isn't a network in place, or where you want to get really good communication with soldiers who are moving through an area.
I'm going to ask the same question as before, but with collaborative robotics, do you think we're getting close to real-world applications? It seems like this is further.
In some ways, I think we're getting fairly close to real-world application. Again, it's sort of along the spectrum of teleoperation to autonomy. In terms of teleoperated robots, teleoperated air vehicles and ground vehicles, I think we're actually very close to being able to deploy those sorts of systems. And we've been collaborating with an air vehicle company called AeroVironment, which also has thousands of these handheld, hand-launched small aircraft that they call the Raven. And we've been integrating our control system with their control system. And I think something like that could be deployed pretty soon.
Okay, I want to look into how soldiers can actually use these robots. I mean, what type of research is needed in terms of human-robot interactions in these systems?
So basically, our goal there is to create robots that are easier and more natural to use. So right now, one of the problems is that, you know, you may have a soldier who's heads down, which means he's looking at a laptop screen, he's joysticking the robot around in a purely teleoperated situation. And that means he doesn't really have situational awareness of his current environment, and you also need another soldier on top of that to protect the soldier who's driving the robot. So now you've got two soldiers who need to drive one robot. Ideally, you want it to be the other way around. You want to be able to have one soldier controlling multiple robots. So one of the ways we're approaching that is figuring out ways that people can interact with the robot more naturally as they would interact with a human member of their squad. So through, for example, hand signals and voice commands, which allows the operator to say, go down this hallway or follow me or stop and those sorts of things. And in that way, we will sort of streamline the process and make it much more intuitive so the soldier, the operator, can do other things besides just joysticking the robot around.
How is it now with the people deployed in Afghanistan and Iraq?
Now it's pretty much all teleoperated.
Does that mean they need special training?
They do need special training. It's generally pretty easy to learn. And, you know, most soldiers these days have experience with video games. So it's not all that different from playing a video game. We even have, like, a PlayStation-inspired controller. So there needs to be some training, but most of the soldiers pick it up pretty quickly.
I spoke with Robin Murphy, and I think they use the PackBot for basically disaster scenarios. And she was looking at the other side of human-robot interaction, so having the robot interacting with people on the field. Are you looking at this aspect at all?
Yeah, we are. It's certainly an area we're interested in terms of general interaction between robots and humans. And so, for example, in an environment where most of the people you're interacting with are civilians, you want to make the robot non-threatening. You want to be able to sort of understand how the robot is how their behavior is interacting with the robot. And this is more long-term research, but it's definitely an area of interest in terms of how, for example, robots at a checkpoint could interact with people in a way that makes them comfortable.
One thing I find amazing we have lots of Roombas around the lab, and they're very robust to people handling them. And that's typically something we don't have in the lab. I mean, we make our robots and we try to make them robust, but we're always very careful handling our own robots, whereas normal people aren't careful at all. And the PackBot also has this feature. So how do you test this? Do you have people, I don't know, throwing them around, or do you give them to people for 3 months and see how they last? I mean, how do you test real people factor?
That's a major factor in why the robots are robust, because we do extensive testing on both the consumer side and the government side. We have, you know, labs both on-site and off-site where people are constantly bashing the robots into things. For, you know, in the case of the PackBot, we actually have a test rig set up where we literally drop them 3 meters on the concrete multiple times to make sure that they still survive and it's not a problem. In the case of the Roomba, when during early development, one of the things they did was they asked for volunteers from the company, and they gave prototypes of these Roombas out to people and tried it out in their apartments. Like, I tried it out of mine, and people tried it in houses, and you have people living in high rises, you have people living in small country homes, you have people living in large suburban dwellings, and one of the things is that you discover that the robots get stuck on different things. And so basically this was an iterative process where, you know, maybe the first time around the robot would go for 5 minutes before getting stuck, and the next time it would go for like 20 minutes, and basically just completely repeat this process until you're reducing the number of things where the robot gets stuck, reducing the number of failure modes, and making it more robust over time.
Okay, the next thing I wanted to look at is a more long-term research-oriented project, the JamBot and ChemBot. First of all, what name should I use?
Well, so there are actually two projects. There's a ChemBots project and a JamBots project. And both of them are funded by DARPA, and they're both designed to investigate how we can build robots that are soft, that aren't necessarily built of metal arms and gears and motors in the way we traditionally think of robots, but rather more biologically inspired robots that can fit through small spaces and so forth.
So these two robots will be the same platform in the end, or there'll be several platforms?
Well, this is a basic research project, so we're not so much developing a near-term platform as we are looking at investigating different techniques that could be applied to platforms in the future.
I saw a beautiful prototype in a video on the internet, which maybe you can describe to our listeners.
So that was probably something from the JamBots project. And that was actually very interesting because it was based initially on this idea of non-Newtonian fluids. So basically things which, for example, something as simple as coffee grains, which alter their properties and under different conditions. So, for example, if you go to a store and you find a block of freeze-dried coffee, it's like a solid brick. But if you allow air into that, it suddenly becomes flexible. And so the idea is you can use particles like this in combination with a source of air, for example, to make different parts of the robots hard or soft. And one of the things we did was we created this thing which was like a soccer ball, which had segments on the outside, each of which could individually be made hard or soft. And this allows, by sequencing this, you have this ball which can actually move on its own by making certain parts soft and parts hard.
What's the interest of iRobot in developing such a platform?
Well, this is sort of, again, long-term research, which is looking at technology that will enable robotics, you know, 10, 20 years from now. And that's basically DARPA's mission, to investigate the very long-term stuff as well as some more near-term stuff. And the goal here is really to sort of push the limits of what's possible.
Do you have any current results with the JamBot?
There's the prototype you saw, and there's some newer work in trying to actually form these. So rather than having a soccer ball type thing, having a legged walker, which walks by having these flexible legs go hard or go soft and things like that.
This makes me think of superheroes, which are sort of melting down, gliding through doors, coming back in a new shape. Is that sort of the background idea?
That's certainly a good comparison, like the Fantastic Four or something like that, where someone can actually go plastic and slide through a mouse hole or something like that. I think there was that inspiration. There was also the inspiration from the Terminator movies, where you have like this liquid metal robot that can slide through small gaps and then become solid again. And also ideas from biology, whereas you've got a mouse or a cat, for example, can slide through a hole that's much smaller than you would imagine because they're flexible on the inside.
I really like this idea of soft robotics, which seems to be really growing currently. Where do you think this will head in the future?
It's tough to say exactly where it'll head, but I think there are a lot of different possibilities in terms of applying robots to environments or missions where they may not currently be capable of. So missions where robots have to be covert, for example, and harder to detect and squeeze into openings where they might not normally fit, as well as applications where maybe you're using different sorts of power sources, where you're not just using batteries, for example, but maybe you're using other sorts of chemical power supplies, that sort of thing.
I wanted to then go a bit on the ethical questions of developing military robots and wanted to have your take on that.
I think, it's key to make robots that are reliable and that you can basically trust to do what the soldier or what the military operator wants them to do. I think it's some extension, robots are an extension of the evolution of military technology, from whether you're talking about guns or tanks or airplanes. It's sort of the next step in terms of the tools that are along the way to perform the missions that the military needs to perform and to keep soldiers out of harm's way. I think it's still a case that the robot is a tool of the human, in the sense that a person is still making the decisions. It's not like we're turning the robots loose and telling them just do what they want.
Do you think there will always be a human in the loop?
I think there will always be a human in the loop at some level. I think that level may increase at times. So I think we'll go from having a person teleoperating it to giving semi-autonomous commands, like go down this hallway or whatever, to potentially higher-level commands, like go into this building and search for it and tell us what you see, that sort of thing. I think, even in the case of human soldiers, there's always a higher-level commander. And so even if eventually, and, this is many years from now, we have robots that are as capable as human soldiers, there will still be a human giving them orders and telling them what to do.
So what do you think tomorrow's wars will look like?
Well, it's tough to say exactly, but I definitely think robots will be a factor in that. I think you will see, especially among the more technologically advanced countries, more and more use of the robots in ground situation as well as air and sea, and more ways of using the robots to safeguard friendly soldiers and so forth. At the same time, we're definitely going to be continuing to fight asymmetric wars where the enemy is not necessarily a large industrial technological power, but will be guerrillas, hiding among the population and using unconventional techniques to fight these wars. So I think one of the big challenges is how can you apply robotics to fighting unconventional wars as opposed to the traditional big army on big army wars.
And what are the future research directions for iRobot?
I think we'll continue looking at the directions we currently have. We're definitely focusing a lot on robot autonomy and also starting to look at ways of integrating autonomous manipulation with autonomous mobility. So robots that can go out into the environment and manipulate objects, open doors, and so forth, as well as moving through the environment and dealing with obstacles and so forth. And I think that's going to be continually a large part of our work. We're also going to be continuing our work in getting robots to be more intuitive to operate and allowing people to interact with them in a more natural way and for getting teams of multiple robots to work together. And we'll always be doing some of the farther out things like CAMBOTS and JAMBOTS, to really look at what's out there in the long term.
I have a final question. How do you see the future of robotics in general?
I think the future of robotics is very bright, and I think it's going to significantly change the way people live in in virtually all aspects of their lives. It's, I think we're sort of in a state in terms of robotics where home computers were back in the late 70s, early 80s, when they were sort of cool toys and hobbyists had them, but they weren't necessarily a part of everyone's daily lives. But nowadays, you know, you have your phone, your smartphone, you have your internet connection. Basically, you're constantly surrounded by computer technology of one way or another. I think that if we look 20, 30 years from now, you will constantly be surrounded by robots, some of which will look maybe humanoid and others which will look completely non-humanoid, but which will be serving you and helping you in the physical world, much like the internet and computers help you in the virtual world.
Thanks, Brian, for being here with us on Robots.
Oh, thank you, Sabine.
We're conducting a survey on the web, and the question that we would like you to discuss is, do you think that the military's involvement in robotics is a good development for the field? Make sure you come onto our forum to debate or get more information on our guests at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Deploy with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.